to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Patuk, your host for today, together with my co-host, Abby Lee. Abby's a relatively new reporter for KHOI, and we're excited to have her joining us. Welcome, Abby, and welcome to all of you, our listeners.
Hello, Kay, and hello to you, our listeners. I expect you've all been enjoying the wonderful sunny day, but cool weather we've been having. It's been a perfect bright and sunny, but not too hot.
But the heat's coming, I believe. Cool weather's over. It looks like that. But Abby, I believe you've got a brief report for us from the music scene. There was a concert on Thursday night from the Main Street Cultural District. I believe it was called the Firefly Country Nights Concert. And Leah Turner was performing there. And you had a brief interview.
Yes, I do, on Leah Turner, a country singer from Tennessee. I'm here with Leah Turner. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. What do you do?
Well, I'm a singer.
What kind of singer?
I sing country music.
That's awesome. When did you start singing?
I've been singing, gosh, ever since I can remember. You know, they have pictures of me when I was, you know, 3 years old playing the piano, and I don't ever remember there was a time where music was not a part of my life.
Yeah, music is a part of my life, too, so I'm trying to become famous by being a rapper. But how did you come about music?
Well, I just don't ever remember music not being a part of my life, so I just, you know, my parents saw a little bit, you know, a gift in me, and I've always been singing since I was very little. It just kind of was always a part of me.
Is singing like an outing? Maybe if you're having a bad day, you can go write a song or, like, sing about something?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I write all of my music and my first two singles and every song that's been on my EP that's on iTunes now. So it definitely is a way to get out emotions or situations that you've been through and go through. It's definitely a way to do that, absolutely.
So can you talk about your two singles? Do the first one first and then your new one.
Yeah, my first single was called Take the Keys, and it went top 40. You know, we all get caught up in everyday life of thinking, you know, about the hustle and the bustle and, you know, forget to fall in love or fall back in love with the one that you're with and the one that's around you. So it's kind of that roll down the windows, pretend your man is Steve McQueen and let him take the keys.
What about your new single?
My new single is called Pull Me Back, and, you know, it's a situation that I went through the night before that, before I went in to write it with John Knight and Jimmy Robbins, and it is just sometimes hugging the edge of the bed is a better choice than hugging the one lying next to you, and we push away when all we want to say to people is pull me back, but we put walls up against our heart to protect us.
What is your favorite song you have written?
Well, besides my two singles, I would have to say a song on my EP called My Finger. You know, it's my anthem to don't cheat. We all have rings that we can give back, and I gave mine back and wrote My Finger.
Oh, okay. My last question is, why did you start singing?
I didn't have a choice. It just came out of me, and it's a gift that the Lord has given me. And so I'm just grateful that I'm able to do it for a job and to be on the Brad Paisley tour all summer and just to be able to, you know, hopefully become the soundtrack to somebody's life like country music has been to mine.
My last question is, what is your most biggest pet peeve, actually?
Golly, my biggest pet peeve would have to be not loyalty. I think being loyal and being real is a very hard thing to do in this day and age, but I still think that you can do it. So just be loyal and be real. And
be yourself.
Be yourself and you know, tell the truth, but don't tell it, you know, out of anger. Tell it always wrapped in love because it's easier to swallow.
That is true. All right, thank you. It was great talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoy your day in Ames, Iowa.
Woohoo!
Well, thank you for that, Abby. And now let's hear Leah Turner's Take the Keys.
Baby, this town built you and me. We wrote our names in the wet concrete. We get caught up in the same routines. Need an escape from reality. There's a getaway car in the driveway parked. Let's hit the road and let the engine spark. We'll be singing out loud to the Rolling Stones, making up a lines that we don't know. I'll ride shotgun, baby, take the lead. So hold my head and let the good years roll in the green light of the stereo. Pretending it's a must.
That was Leah Turner's Take the Keys. Well, today, July the 21st, is special because it's the day that this year's American Solar Challenge race starts out. Setting out from the University of Texas, our own Iowa State University has a car they've designed and built taking part in that race. So it's especially exciting for us. And what makes it even more exciting is that Ames is an official checkpoint or pit stop on the race. All the cars in this nationwide race must stop here in Ames, and they'll be here this coming Saturday, July the 26th. There's a special community event organized around this pit stop. We'll be hearing more about this and the American Solar Challenge race and the ISU's own solar car later in today's program from some special guests.
But first, Kay, I think you have a segment on for us in our Community Service Appreciation Series.
Yes, thank you, Abby. In our Community Service Appreciation Program, we highlight one non-profit community service each month. This month, we're featuring CCJ, the Center for Creative Justice, a non-profit probation office for adult low-risk offenders. As we'll hear today, this program is almost unique in the nation. Earlier this month, I spoke with Mark Kubik, the executive director of CCJ. My guest today is Christy Boyer, one of the probation officers at CCJ. I'm here with Christy Boyer from the Center for Creative Justice, which is on Lynn Avenue in Ames. And recently I interviewed the executive director of CCJ, the Center for Creative Justice, Mark Kubik. And he told us about the kind of work that the center does. However, for those listeners that have missed the interview with Mark, I'm going to ask Christy Boyer to recap the work of CCJ. Christy is a probation officer, and we're going to talk with her about the day-to-day work of a probation officer at CCJ. But let's start with a general outline of what CCJ does.
We are a nonprofit probation office here in Story County. We had started back in 1974. Our clients are adult, so we just supervise adult probationers. We get the clients from the court system, and we make sure that they are doing the things that they're supposed to be doing on probation as far as mental health evaluations and things. But with our supervision, we are really very, very unique because there's not many that we have found in the nation, such as a nonprofit probation office. We supervise the biggest part of the clients in Story County. I think it's about 85% for first-time offenders and low-risk offenders.
Right. And if you weren't supervising them, which is a very low-cost thing, I think Mark mentioned it was $300 a year it costs.
The minimum, offender. Yes, correct.
Yeah. And that is paid by the offender.
Correct.
If that wasn't happening, they'd be in prison or jail, which is about, is it $30,000 a year for the taxpayer?
Yeah,
pays.
So it's just about 1% of what it would cost. And it is, like you said, it is paid, all of our enrollment fees are paid by the probationers.
Right, and there probably wouldn't be much rehabilitation in prison either.
No.
Unfortunately.
Correct.
So this is, for everybody, this works much better if
correct.
Possible. Take us through a typical day, your day-to-day work as a probation officer at CCJ, if you would.
Most of us supervise clients about, we have anywhere from 100-plus clients that we meet with each month. So basically on a day-to-day basis, we may be meeting with clients that's anywhere from 8 to 10 clients a day.
Those figures, that each probation officer has that many?
Or? Yes.
That's a lot.
Some of us have a smaller caseload just because of our different backgrounds as far as the type of clientele that we do supervise. But most of us, we have at least about 100 clients or more that we supervise. And like I said, we supervise them at least once a month. Sometimes we supervise them more often. With my caseload, I usually start out with about every 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
So we meet with them. They come into our office. We go over what the requirements are of their particular case, such as the mental health evaluation, substance abuse eval. And then we are making sure that they're getting those things done.
Right. And so you're holding them accountable.
Yes.
And making them, yeah.
Yes. So we make sure that they have the evaluations done, that they are in treatment. They can't find a place, you know, for treatment or whatever. We help them with that.
So this would be treatment for things like mental health, substance abuse.
Yes.
Anything else?
Bachelor's education. They have to complete that.
So oh, bachelor's.
Yes.
Bachelor's
so it would be for the men's and then the women's education program.
So are the women bachelors then?
Yes.
Not many, though, I assume.
I have more men than women, but I do have a small caseload of women that have been arrested for either assault, but in the nature of domestic violence.
But are they assaulting their male partners, or is it a female partner, or their children, or what?
It kind of varies. I do have both of men and women, so
women
female partners and
men,
partners.
Do they?
Sometimes they do, yes.
I had heard that, but it's hard to visualize, and it certainly doesn't fit with one's preconceived ideas. You've sort of covered this a bit, the kinds of problems that you see, substance abuse, mental health problems that lead to various usually nonviolent crimes, although obviously domestic violence is violence, and I mentioned substance abuse. And presumably that involves driving while intoxicated and things like that.
Yes, it's possession of drugs, possession of paraphernalia, OWIs, public intox, those sorts of crimes.
Right.
And then we also have, you know, people that are on probation that are there for theft, forgery, sometimes child endangerment, driving under suspension. So if their driver's license was suspended or revoked.
Is that common, actually? They have their license suspended and they keep driving?
Yes.
And it's usually being suspended because they were driving under the influence?
It can be that or like a possession charge.
Okay.
Because if they're under the influence of, say, marijuana, then they could, pick up charges from that.
Do the different probation officers specialize in different areas?
Yes, we have one that specializes in mental health, another that does repeat offenders. He actually worked for the Department of Corrections for over 30 years, so he comes with great experience. Mm-hmm. Then we have, you know, the others really kind of take a general caseload. Mm-hmm. A lot of those are, you know, substance abuse cases mm-hmm. and things, but they do take a general caseload. And then myself, I have the domestic violence cases.
So, and that's your specialty?
Yes.
Well, that's very interesting. I'll get back to the battering and domestic violence. What kind of crimes, I suppose, I want to ask? I don't know how to put this quite. Mental health isn't a crime. What kind of crimes do people have mental health issues commit?
It really kind of varies. I mean, any of the above crimes that I have mentioned can be committed by someone that has mental health issues. Substance abuse sometimes is a big one.
Because they're using drugs as a sort of self-medication?
Yes,
or?
Yes. And OWIs or public intox, you know, sometimes thefts, you know, burglaries. It just kind of just depends.
Now, I don't know if you get into the sort of psychiatry of this, but do certain crimes go with certain diagnoses?
I think it really just kind of it varies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we see any specific diagnosis that, you know, just people that have thefts on their record, you know, commit or OWIs or anything like that. It varies.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit more about domestic violence, because that is, well, the problem with that is a sort of hidden crime, you might say, and people don't report it. So what is your unique perspective on domestic violence, your sort of philosophy when you look at this as a problem?
Where I started my career at a domestic violence shelter in Kansas, and I worked there for, I think it was 6 to 7 years. I was an advocate. I was a court advocate. Mm-hmm. So I went with the victims and helped with the protection from abuse orders and stalking orders. But the other piece that I also did was I met with the batters before their arraignment in city court. Just to talk about pretty much what their consequences were going to be, you know, once they go in front of the judge, talk to them just briefly about, you know, if they continue that behavior, what, you know, the effects on the relationship as well as, you know, on their children if they have children. So that kind of got me, you know, interested in probation. And so with coming to CCJ, because I'm kind of, you know, I do have meet with some victims and things like that because, you know, sometimes we come across, you know, any of our clients can be a victim of domestic violence. So I do have that aspect where I can, you know, do some safety planning and
yes.
and talk to them about some of the dynamics and things.
Right.
But I also have changed and I solely work with domestic violence batterers, whether it's the men or the other women. I think my perspective has kind of changed. I mean, yes, what they did was wrong, but maybe trying to get them some help in a lot of cases, unless they're ready to change, it may not help, but at least it's giving them some seeds and some opportunities to maybe make some changes so they're not continuing the behavior. And, you know, in some of them, I can see some great changes. Others, you know, I know that I may very well see them again at some point or another.
Yes.
But, you know, I have seen some good changes, I think, and some of them. I mean, of course, I'm not with them all the time, so I don't, you know, always know exactly what goes on behind, you know, closed doors when they're not meeting with me. But I do feel that some of them have made some great changes.
Right.
And some of that is with the Batterers Education Program that the Department of Corrections, who is in charge of that program, it is 6 months long, so it's not, you know, a weekend class or a class that they may only go 6 weeks or whatever. It is 6 months long, so it's a very intensive program.
And do you, I don't know if the word is teach, do you teach in that or is that different personnel?
Most of us at CCJ, we are trained facilitators in the Batterers Education Program. The Duluth model, they have now since changed to another model that they're using, but we are, you know, trained in that. So I don't teach per se, but, you know, I know enough that I can kind of pick some points out and kind of talk with my clients about, you know, if they continue the behavior, obviously what's going to happen if they continue, you know, throughout the court system, stiffer, you know, consequences, what, you know, they're doing to, you know, their partner, if they continue it, as well as what, you know, the dynamics, you know, with their children.
Right,
and what they're
right.
having to go through and what they're seeing and, you know, a good chance that they may
up. Do you personally, when you're talking to these people, do you get the sense that they are sincerely, deeply sorry every time this happens, most of them, and then they just lose control again, or that they're complacent about it?
With some of them, I do think that they are sorry that it happened. And I think with some of them, at least getting to the point where, you know, police are called, you know, I think it may have been the one-time incident and they realized that they did, they should have made some other choices and
right,
not,
right.
you know, whether push their partner or slap their partner or whatever the case of may have
right,
been.
Right.
I think they do realize that, and I think, you know, those are the people that, you know, we can hopefully get to early on. And, you know, one good thing about probation is that we can get them to them hopefully early on
right.
to get into the Batterer's Education Program, make sure that they are completing that program and kind of talking about, you know, where are some things you're learning class? You know, let's talk about that and how does that fit back into your relationship or why you're here, you know, today, you know, on probation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of start seeing some light bulbs turning and, uh-huh. and they know that they are, what they did was wrong. They're trying to take some of that responsibility and they're trying to hopefully take some of the tools that they have learned in the Batterer's Education Program and utilize that into their life and making some different changes.
Yes, I think maybe this is typical of many of our listeners. My experience of this is really from things like cop shows, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's maybe extreme and not the kind of offenders you're talking about. But the picture I have in my mind is, part of my mind is saying, oh, this is all useless because these guys have got their wives terrorized
mm-hmm.
and they're not going to report them. And the wives are going to say everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings up another related question that was in my mind, is that you mentioned that you see the victims of violence,
mm-hmm.
of domestic violence, if they have also offended in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a routine thing to talk to them, to the victims.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes it's if, you know, issues have come up, you know, that they're, you know, that I maybe come in contact with them, that we need to kind of talk about. Or if they have questions, you know, I can't tell them specifically, you know, about their partner's case or anything. But, you know, if they're wanting to know more about the BEP classes or the Batterer's Education Program, you know, what that entails, I can talk to them about
mm-hmm.
that. And,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
But some of the victims, you know, we do come in contact with is that maybe there are our clients, but for other things. And so we can make sure that they get the number for ACCESS, which is the local domestic
right,
violence
right.
shelter here in Ames, getting, you know, talking about some safety planning until they can get over there and talk with them, you know, letting them know that there are services and other ways that, you know, such as the no-contact orders, the local resources here in Ames to help them to be able to get out of that situation,
yes.
you know, if they choose.
I'm talking with Christy Boyer, a probation officer for the Center for Creative Justice here in Ames. Christy specializes in cases of domestic abuse. And at this juncture, I'll insert a brief announcement about the services of ACCESS, the Assault Care Center extending shelter and support. This is a shelter and support resource for victims of sexual and domestic abuse. You can find them on the web, www.assaultcarecenter.org. Their crisis line is 1-855-696-2980. We'll also put this information on our website. Is it true that my picture that I mentioned, you know, that I guess it's pretty hardened kind of batterers and,
mm-hmm.
and of course, fictional too, in cop shows, is that not typically what you see or sort of pretty hardened and they present, you know, they're good at fooling people, but
mm-hmm.
they're not battering?
Yeah, and I do come in contact with those people too. You know, I get a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Those are, I guess, the ones that maybe it's the first time that they, or as far as what we know, is the first time that they have hit their partner or whatever the case may have been. Those are, you know, some of, I guess, the better case scenarios that, you know, we can hopefully plant that seed and get them the help, you know, sooner than later, and hopefully they are learning something from that. Then there are the ones that, you know, I probably will see again at some point or another. Sometimes those are the ones that, yeah, you can send them to the batterer's education classes. They can say that they're getting what they're supposed to be getting out of it. They can do all the lessons and things like that. But unless they're truly ready to make some changes in their lives, they're probably not going to. And those are, I think, some of the worst case scenarios of the ones that maybe you typically think of,
yes,
that their partner, you know, is afraid, you know, for their safety or for their kids' safety. So, you know, yeah, I do get a little bit of both.
Would you say in your experience that it's true that batterers are absolutely terrified of that? I'm talking about male batterers now, I guess. Or maybe it's true of female batterers, absolutely terrified of their wives leaving them?
Yeah, I mean, that's if their partner leaves them, they won't have that power and control over them.
Right.
And, you know, with domestic violence, it's about power and control.
Right.
Sometimes the partner leaving their abuser sometimes is worse for them, for the victim, just because,
well,
you know, it kind of escalates their safety,
yeah,
I guess if you want to say,
more.
Yeah. Just because, you know, they're not in that relationship, they don't know exactly what their partner is doing at that time, or, you know, and their partner knows that, okay, my wife has left me, then, you know, they don't have that power and control over them any longer. And sometimes that's when you see some of the homicides and things.
Well, that's why shelters act like access. Its exact location is a secret.
Correct.
And presumably most of these shelters are, or all of them.
Usually they are, yes.
It's absolutely... So they're presumably pretty safe there. But
yes.
Yeah. So that was one of my ideas that was accurate, that it can be, in a sense, more dangerous to leave. But in the long term, it might be the only answer.
Yes. I mean,
because he's either going to be without a partner or he's going to change his ways.
Yeah, and they can get out of that situation, you know, because it's not, most likely it's not going to get any better. It's just going to continue to get worse and worse.
Right.
You know, and that's why it's very important that the victims know that there are other resources out there,
right,
and there are ways that they can get out of that situation.
Now, you say most likely it's not going to get better, it's going to get worse and worse. But you're not talking about all cases there. You mean in particular kinds of cases.
Like I said, there are some that I see that I do think that was, you know, an isolated incident, not saying what, you know, he or she
that
did
sort
was
of
right.
It in
but
the bud,
yeah.
And, yeah, before it became a habit,
yes,
you might say.
Whereas, you know, you have, like, you think about as far as what, an abuser, you know, having that power and control over their victim, yeah, they're, you know, they're going to continue doing what they're doing. Doesn't, like I said, it doesn't matter if you have them go to batterer's education classes over and over again. They're not going to get it. They're not going to make those changes because some of it's the, you know, the belief system that they have is deep-rooted. You know, whether that was the way their grandpa was and then their dad was and then now they are.
Right.
Sometimes it goes from generation to generation.
In fact, I did ask Mark about that. Sort of something they learned, is a learned behavior.
Yeah.
And of course, if you read old literature, it used to be a belief, and of course it still is in many cultures.
Yes.
That husbands have the wife right to beat their wives. I remember getting into an argument with some foreign students when I was quite young, an undergraduate. They were saying, these were nice guys, you know. Well, of course, sometimes you have to beat your wife, they were saying. And I said, you know, you can't get it. If you did that in this country, you'd be in prison for it. And you can't always get everyone to do what you want. That's just the way human relationships are, and you have to accept that. And how would you like your wife beating you? I said.
Yeah.
But apparently it does happen.
It does.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to visualize that. Is it just a quick slap, or they throw something at them, or
as far as the women or the men?
A woman attacking. I mean, you see almost comedies of women throwing plates at guys' heads and things like that. You can tell the lot.
Right.
I'm getting all this from movies. But what kind? I can't visualize it really.
Sometimes it's, you know, whether things are being thrown around, you know, during an argument. or sometimes, yeah, that they do slap them.
And then what does the guy do? I mean, and it must be hard for a man to say, to report this, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
So in what kind of circumstances does this come to your notice? Because I know women are often reluctant to report abuse, but men, I would think, would be even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they can't batter her back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and some of the female batters that I do have, or, you know, I have worked with in the past, I guess I should say, that some of them, there has been years of abuse or there have been some other abuse, and maybe they're just lashing out at that moment. So maybe they're
beating up someone, or they're hitting someone that's been beating them up, you're saying?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, they still have that domestic charge because, you know, they did, they was maybe found as the aggressor at that particular incident. But, you know, some of the clients may be more so the victim than the abuser.
Right.
But we
okay.
still have to hold
okay.
them accountable
sure.
for,
sure.
you know,
right.
that incident as far as what happened. And,
uh-huh.
and you know, we can kind of talk about, you know, some healthy relationships and, you know, and things to kind of look out for and, you know, and different resources that's, you know, in the community to help them. But, you know, like I said, I do have some that they are more the aggressor
right.
and than, you know, their male partner. Domestic violence just doesn't, you know, pertain to women, which that's usually what you always think of. There are a lot of males that are truly victims of domestic violence. Sometimes you don't always hear about that. But there's more out there than what, you know, one would think.
And, of course, if it's same-sex couple, that
yes.
I mean, it'd be a man beating up another man or a woman yep. beating up another woman.
Yeah. I mean, there's still, you know, there's still a lot of victims out there. It's just,
right.
you know, like you said, it's very hard for a woman to, you know, to call the police and to report that incident. It's hard, you know, for men to do that as well because, you know, they're afraid that they're going to, be, you know, perceived as the weaker sex and, you know, lots of different things that, you know, comes with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you got any upbeat stories of success in your program or from the other probation officers, big successes that come to mind? Or
yes, one particular one that comes to mind was with another probation officer, but received an email basically being thanked for, you know, his help. This person, I believe, had been an alcoholic and, you know, for years and everything. And with coming to CCJ and on probation and working with his probation officer, he was able to turn it around. And he's since been sober. And I believe he's, you know, holding a job and everything. And, you know, he did all the work. I mean,
right.
But he definitely was very, very thankful of CCJ and his probation officer for the help and support and things like that he was able to receive. And, you know, he's doing really well right now.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add that's important about the work of CCJ?
I have definitely seen CCJ grow since I've been there, since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Our clientele definitely has grown a lot. I mean, we have about 700 and some clients, you know, at any given time. But I think one great thing is we are always trying to find different trainings and trying to stay up to date with all the new information regarding mental health or substance abuse, domestic violence. And Mark's given us the opportunity to be able to, you know, go to those trainings and learn a lot more. We also try to keep up to date with all the different resources in
sure.
Ames because, you know, that's one big thing that, you know, clients are struggling, especially with unemployment.
Right. Well, I noticed all the links on your website.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And that's one thing that we kind of had started. We have an employment center at CCJ, which has a computer, and we have two notebooks that has the current positions in Ames. So that way any of our clients can come in at any time and they can search for jobs, they can fill out applications, You know, something we really have worked hard on.
And get help with filling out the application.
Yeah, as probation officers are available and everything. Mm-hmm. But we just have, I think, grown and continue growing. And, you know, I think we do a great job at...
It sounds like it, yes.
You know, keeping our... You know, our clients are being held accountable, but on the other hand, they're also getting some of those resources.
Right.
But, you know, we do have an obligation to the court, and there definitely is that accountability piece. But we're also help rehabilitating them. I think 2012, 90% of our clients didn't reoffend after that. So I think that's a huge
impressive.
Success.
That is very impressive. Yes. Well, it sounds as if CCJ, the Center for Creative Justice, is doing terrific work. This is a great resource we have here in Ames. And I've been talking to Christy Boyer from the Center for Creative Justice. She's a probation officer specializing in domestic violence. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us today, Christy.
Yes, thank you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Abby Lee, one of your hosts, along with my co-host, Kay Potok. We just heard an interview that Kay recorded with Christy Boyer, a probation officer with the Center of Creative Justice for Creative Justice here in Ames. We're featuring CCJ in today's edition of KHOI's Community Service Appreciation Series.
If any of you, our listeners out there, are part of a nonprofit organization that you'd like us at KHOI to feature in the coming months, or if you've benefited from such an organization, we'd like to hear from you. We'll help get the word out about your organization by featuring you here on Local Talk and also by broadcasting public service announcements about your organization every day throughout the featured month. Contact me, Kay Puttock, at khiradio@gmail.com and mention the Community Service Appreciation Program. But now... There are three special guests who are here in the studio to tell us about an exciting event coming up in Ames this week, connected with the American Solar Challenge, which is a competition to design and build solar-powered cars and then to drive them in a cross-country event. Iowa State University is taking part in the American Solar Challenge in several ways, not just because ISU's Team Prism has got a car entered into the race, but also because Ames is an official checkpoint for the whole race. So first, I'll introduce Alison Walter, who's a manager of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. Welcome, Alison.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also here in the studio are Gina Gingery and Abby Barfoot, who are both on the planning team for the community event that's coming up in Ames this Saturday, July the 21st. Hello, Gina and Abby.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I believe the Solar Challenge race is starting today, July 21st, at the University of Texas in Austin, and it will finish at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis on July 28th. But this coming Saturday, July 26th, the race will be passing through Ames. So Gina, is Ames the official checkpoint for all the cars in the race?
Yes, it is for that day. There's a checkpoint at every day, but on Saturday, July 26th, Ames is the official checkpoint. The cars stop, and they have to take a break for 1 hour, and then they're on their way again and headed to La Crosse, Wisconsin.
That's cool. And Abby, how does the pit stop work?
So the American Solar Challenge is Tour de France style, which means between each stop, the cars are timed for how fast they can get to each checkpoint. At the checkpoint, cars stop for an hour, and then they go on to the stage stop, which is the official stopping point for the night.
I believe the pit stop is also a community event for the area residents. What can people expect at the community event? What is the purpose of the event?
Yes, the community event, we wanted to make the whole checkpoint community-related, so get not only people to come out and see the cars, which is exciting in itself, but to also hold an event where we have that's kind of focused on sustainability. So we have different exhibitors that have sustainability things, like there's one with a robot. Kids can come and make a wind turbine. There's different challenges with that, so they can race different things. There's also they can make solar cars, little model solar cars. So it's really a fun event for all ages, zero to however old. And so we want everybody to come out and participate in the hands-on event, but then also cheer on our Team Prism and all the other cars coming through, because it's not every day you get to see a solar car come through Ames.
Why should our listeners enjoy coming to the Pit Stop event?
Well, I think they've covered some of that already.
We're hoping to just give people an opportunity to get out and see other, you know, other community members and have a community event, as well as being able to highlight the College of Engineering and the Solar Car Program. The City of Ames has some exhibits that they're going to have, and some of our local businesses. There'll be a hybrid car out from Ames Ford. There'll be a solar oven from the City of Ames. Mm-hmm. There'll be a solar charging station from Interstate Battery, and Power Film, which is a company here in town, is going to bring out their solar charging also.
That's amazing. Where will the event be located?
It is in Lot D2, which is north of Jack Trice Stadium, and the community event is 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, July 26th.
Now, the ISU solar car, I notice you look at pictures of these cars, some have got three wheels, some have got four wheels. I just wondered if you could describe the car. We'll probably get a picture of it up on our website, but for people that are listening right now, maybe.
So the solar car looks a lot different than your traditional car that you would see on the road. It's either three or four wheels. It's also a lot lower to the ground. And if you saw it, it kind of looks like a spaceship to be aerodynamic. So the top of the car is has a little bubble in which the driver can see out of. And then the entire top of the car is filled with solar cells. And they're made out of a composite material, either carbon fiber or fiberglass. So it's a lot lighter than your traditional car. Also, unlike a car that you would drive down the road, the driver sits in the middle of the car rather than on the left-hand side, and it's only for one passenger. So it's built more for speed than for comfort.
And what speed do these solar cars customarily go at?
Our car, Phaeton, which is our 12th car that Iowa State has built, can go up to 75 miles per hour. Actually, at the track race this week, we got fastest lap for our car, but 75 miles per hour isn't really a sustainable speed for the car, so usually their cruising speed is about 45 miles per hour.
And you are part of, Abby, you're part of Team Prism at ISU, and I love the way you spell Prism, it's or where you write Prism, because the ISU part is in capitals there. So what role does this student organization play, Team Prism?
Prism plays a lot of different roles. It's really a great opportunity for students in all sorts of different majors to get involved and get hands-on experience. We have engineers in the aerospace department, electrical engineering, computer engineering, but we're not just engineers. We are one of the larger clubs on campus when it comes to our budget. So we have an amazing business team who works with all of our sponsors. We have public relations people who come out and talk about the car. And students go on to do amazing jobs and internships within the past year. We've had team members go to Caterpillar, Microsoft, SpaceX, NASA. So they really have great hands-on experiences that job employers really look for.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Sounds fascinating. Now, what role does Dr. Joel Johnson play in this?
Dr. Johnson is the Director of Engineering Student Services, so he's helped plan the event with us, along with Allison and I, and this whole event is sponsored or put on by both the Provost Office and the College of Engineering.
Well, it certainly sounds as if, you know, this is a highly complex thing, but you're making it very accessible to people of all ages, so it sounds as if it'll be very interesting. Are there any other activities that Team Prism does at Iowa State?
We do a lot of outreach throughout the year, so one of the things is not just building a car, but letting people know that we're on campus and we're available. So we do a lot of outreach with students that are coming into Iowa State. We also do community events like the Eco Fair this past year. So we really like to get our name out there and show students that engineering can be fun and exciting and really applicable.
Mm-hmm. And would one of you, I suppose maybe that would be you, Abby, would one of you like to tell our listeners more about the Solar Challenge in general? That's the race as a whole, I guess.
Yeah, Yeah, so the American Solar Challenge has been going on since 1990. And fun fact, Team Prism is the only team who has built and raced a new car every year that the American Solar Challenge has got on.
Yeah, it doesn't happen every year, does it?
No, it's every 2 years. Uh-huh. And this year we have 10 cars competing in the Solar Challenge, not just from the United States, but we also have a team from Iran, Canada, and Puerto Rico, I believe, that are racing this year. And it starts in Austin, Texas, and it goes to St. Paul, Minnesota. And there's a series of checkpoints along the race. We drive on all the same roads that cars would go, and we obey all the same traffic laws. So we're right there with all the other cars.
So you might be driving along and pass one of these solar cars, or it might pass you.
Yep.
Yeah. And how long is the course of the race? I guess some people do be able to do that in their heads from what you said, but what is the length of the race?
It's a 5-day race, and it's 1,200 miles or 1,800 miles across the country.
And you've already mentioned how often it's held. Is the course of the race always the same, or does it vary in different years?
It does vary from different years. The previous year, we went from Rochester, New York, to St. Paul, Minnesota. So usually it does end in Minnesota, but we've had races go from, I think, Florida. We went through Canada 1 year. So it really changes depending on the race year.
Okay, so I'll just sum up. Everyone should come out for this pit stop event. Is that the right term to use? Which is this coming Saturday, July the 26th, from 1 to 4 p.m. in the D2 parking lot north of Jack Trice Stadium.
Correct.
Did I leave anything out? No.
Well, I just wanted to mention that all the cars have to stop at some point during the day. We don't know when they're going to stop. So we are going to actually have a map where we're going to try to keep track of where the cars are throughout the day so that you can kind of have an idea of if there's one coming soon. But also, I wanted to mention that there's a great Twitter feed and there's Facebook posts. If you search ISU or Team Prism on either application, you can find them. And you could follow them throughout the week. I was kind of watching over the weekend and finding all about the qualification rounds that they've been doing. And so just sort of to follow throughout the week and get an idea of what's going on would be kind of fun as well.
Yeah, it would. Yes. So. Sounds like a lot of fun. Well, thank you all. Alison Walter from the Ames Visitors Bureau.
Yep.
Abby Barfoot from Team Prism. And Gina Gingery from Team Prism.
College of Engineering.
Anyway, thank you for joining us today and telling us about the American Solar Challenge and the Prism Solar Car Team and this exciting event on Saturday.
And earlier in the show, we heard about the music of Leah Turner, and we also heard Kay speaking with Christy Boyer, a probation officer who works with the Center for Creative Justice.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes here, so since we've got Alison here from the Visitors Bureau, I'm going to put her on the spot here and ask her about other exciting events that we've got coming up in Ames this week.
Sure. Well, I did want to mention it's not actually in Ames, but this week in Story County in Nevada, the Story County 4-H Fair is going on through Wednesday. Of course, there's the Municipal Band Concert on Thursday evening. And there's an evening prairie walk that Story County Conservation is doing on Thursday evening at Doolittle Prairie. This is the last weekend of the Iowa Games, the third weekend, and it's mostly adult competitions this weekend, so you won't see quite as many people in town as you did this past weekend, but it will still be a number of people in town for Iowa Games. Heartland Senior Services is doing their community trivia night on Friday evening, and you can take advantage of that. And then we have the music at the band shell. There will be bookends at the band shell over the noon hour on Friday. And Ames on the half shell. Abby Normal is the band performing Friday evening. The Story Theater Company is doing their summer variety show on Friday evening. And don't forget on Saturday afternoon, the Solar Challenge Checkpoint.
Yeah, the pièce de la résistance.
Right.
Now we've got a bit of time left, so let's hear some more Leah Turner. This is My Finger.
Mama gave me a warning, said you have a wondering now. It hit me this morning, I don't buy your alibi. I was picking out flowers, and I was tasting cakes. You were picking up women, staying out too late. Don't think I'm walking down that aisle. You won't see me dressing right. Won't be no wedding night. Gonna trade my blue and barrel for someone new. Forget the honeymoon. I'll never say I do. If it's the doer's part, I'll have a funeral for you. You dug your grave the day you kissed her. Take your ring and here's my finger. Your t-shirt, the one with her lipstick stained. Don't worry, you can keep her. I'm keeping my last name. So save your sorrows and save your breath. To me, your history, I'm your regret.
That was Leah Turner's My Finger. Leah was one of the musicians playing this Thursday at a concert organized by the Main Street Cultural District. And she was interviewed here on Local Talk by our new reporter, Abby Lee. Okay, and before we go, we'd like to announce that KHO Radio is very proud to be hosting an annual national radio conference, co-sponsored by Pacifica Radio here in downtown Ames. The Grassroots Radio Conference, or GRC, will take place August the 14th to the 17th this year, this coming August. Visit the website at www.grc2014.net. The GRC is a professional conference comprising one cornerstone of national non-commercial community media, and it's widely loved among radio operators and radio fans. Visitors to the conference will be traveling to Ames from the USA and Canada, all across the USA. And we're expecting 150 to 200 attendees, radio producers, journalists, legal experts, engineers, and community radio volunteers like Abby and me here. We're excited to further introduce the magic of community radio. Therefore, if you live in central Iowa, we're inviting you to stop by the conference anytime and join in for the cost of $20 a day pass. We'll be holding a potluck welcome party on August the 14th at 5 p.m. in front of KHOI. It's a sort of barbecue style at 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames, downtown Ames, right outside our building here and inside our building. Join us, bring a dish, or just stop by to help welcome the guests, some of them very distinguished guests. This is a great opportunity for you to learn more about who we are at KHOI. Be lots of fun. You'll meet amazing people and discover the magic of building community through communication.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and tell all of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. We will post the show on our homepage of our website later today. And as always, we will post links to events and organizations we discuss.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, we always need more reporters.
Yep.
We work too hard and we need some help around here. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org, or just drop by and see us in the studio. It's in the old Pantorium building opposite the Octagon, 410 Douglas.
Your participation as an audience and your generous donation help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Today, thank you so much for coming in.
This is Jackie Dean. You're listening to The Hard...